The idea of eternal return is a mysterious one, and Nietzsche has often perplexed other philosophers with it. To think that everything recurs as we once experienced it, and that the recurrence itself recurs ad infinitum. What does this mad myth signify? So began Milan Kundera's book, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, which we made into a film 10 years ago. My name is Phil Kaufman. I directed this film, and now, 10 years later, I'm returning to it. Kundera has called himself a hedonist caught in a world politicized to the extreme. And here we see Daniel Day-Lewis playing the hedonist Kundera. In a way, he's playing Kundera. Kundera would deny it, but in my mind, Tomas is certainly a variation of Kundera. So it just is in the opening. We hear giggling behind a door, and we never see, or a wall, and we never see what's going on. Here, once again, we have the voyeurs watching this. It's not only the voyeurs, but it's also Tomas being the womanizer that he is. I mean, Tomas is a man who's fully committed to the life of lightness, really. But voyeurism has a strong hold on everybody, even the patient on the table, who may be dying, suddenly is stirred back to life by his voyeuristic instincts.
The bastard.
How does he do it?
One, two, three.
And this scene in bed has a number of interesting things, the most interesting of which is Lena Olin, who, Swedish actress I met in Sweden, who was phenomenally talented and beautiful and strong-willed. And the other thing is her hat, which is a motif that runs throughout the film. And a lot of this film is motifs repeated. And as they are repeated, we see the different variations of the hat in the different places it's seen. One thing I liked about this shot is a number of shots in the film was that it's all one shot. It's all done in one movement. To me, that just binds the characters together. It's all of the action is, it's the reality of the action is totally there. It's not something that was edited and put together.
You are the complete opposite of Kitsch. In the kingdom of Kitsch.
I'm Lena Olin, and I play Sabina in this movie. I met Saul Zantz because he came to Sweden for the 10th anniversary of the running of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in Stockholm. And I think that Saul, after that, went back to the States and said to Phil, go and check this girl out. If she's any good, I think she would be a good choice for Sabina. And Phil watched after the rehearsal, and then he flew to Sweden to see me. And we had a great meeting, and that's how it started.
Now, once again, we're hearing the laughter. Maybe this is the same laughter we were hearing behind the door at the beginning. Now, here we're seeing Tomas in close-up, and if anything, I think this indicates it's an intimate, what is to become an epic, an intimate epic, rather than a big epic. It really is a story of Tomas as he goes through all these adventures, really where we're going to see empires, assert themselves and empires shaken and so forth. But that close-up on his face is really, really the dimension that I was, and Jean-Claude and all of us were most interested in, was this man, Tomas. This was a scene we shot in a place called Luxeuil in France. It was an old spa town, and it was very similar to Czech spa towns. And we had a number of Czech people, particularly Jan Nemec, who was the Czech filmmaker who you'll see later in the film, advising us on the authentic qualities. That's a Czech car. That, in fact, is a Skoda, license plates. We were trying to be careful on every single detail here. All of the information up there, the circulars and stuff, are from Czech spas.
I'm Jean-Claude Carrière. I'm a French writer and screenwriter. And I worked with Phil Kaufman on the writing of the script of The Unbearable Lightness of Being, based on the Milan Kundera's novel. I had met Kundera in Prague in 68, during the very famous, you know, Prague Spring. We were working with Miloš Forman on Taking Off, already that Miloš would shoot in New York in 69. And then later, in 1975, Kundera left finally Czechoslovakia and came to Paris. It means that I was in Prague precisely at the moment when the events of the film did happen. I knew the people, I knew their hopes, their despair, all the problems, you know, that Miloš Forman and Ivan Passer and Kitilova and many other Czech filmmakers had to face during the summer of 68, after the invasion of the Russian, of the troops of the Warsaw Pact. And I knew all this atmosphere, which was a very dramatic and pathetic one, and in the same time with some very comical aspect.
Well, he never misses a chance, this guy. He's, you know, I mean, you operate on a brain and then you go out for a little fun. And he's just, you know, sort of on the prowl. This was all taken out of stills and things that we'd seen of, you know, in Czechoslovakia, guys playing chess, and Tomas being, you know, is probably a great chess player himself, being a game player. And right about here, suddenly something upsets the chess game. And the Black King falls over, and perhaps that's a portent about Tomas, that, you know, maybe in fact he's the Black King, and this is the introduction of Teresa, Juliette Binoche, and there's something about her that lures him. And from this point on, Tomas will become a different man.
I'm Walter Mertz. I was the supervising editor on Unbearable Lightness, and working with me in editorial were Steve Rotter, B.J. Sears, and Vivian Gilliam. I had worked on three films for Zoetrope. Zoetrope was started by Francis Coppola and George Lucas together, and all three of us came up from Los Angeles to San Francisco. We were all young ex-student filmmakers, and we were dissatisfied with the kind of filmmaking that we had seen at the studios at that time, and we wanted to continue to make the kind of films we had made at film school, but to make them professionally. There didn't seem to be that opportunity for us in Los Angeles, so we came to San Francisco. Phil was one of the filmmakers who felt the same way that we did. He'd come from Chicago, and he had an office at Zoetrope and was making a film called The White Dawn. So we got to know each other then. I was editing the conversation at the time that he was editing White Dawn. I think he admired my persistence and tenacity in trying to accomplish all of what I was trying to accomplish with the conversation. And we had tried to work together on a couple of other occasions, but our schedules just had not overlapped until the Unbearable Lightness of Being.
Right here, she turns on the radio, and this is Beethoven quartet playing, and that was Kundera talked about that quite a bit in the book, Beethoven, the sense of weight and so forth. Pierre Gouffroy did the sets and so forth here, and I think these were wonderfully done. You know, you can really feel the spa, the moisture has crept into these walls and pulled out the wallpaper and so forth. This is really a scene from the book. Juliette Binoche I had met I had met her once in Paris on an interview, and then she mysteriously disappeared. She went to South America, where her father was living. And it was only just before we began shooting the film that she returned to Paris. And I had a reading in my room with her and Daniel. She really was magical. You could search the earth for an actress like this, and somehow fate delivered her to us. Number six, that's another motif that's repeated. And, yeah, this is the introduction. I mean, there's something so innocent and, you know, the eroticism of her face, whereas with Lena Olin, it was, you know, the body that was the physical thing. This was the eroticism of the angel.
Around six.
I remember sitting next to her here against the wall, and Juliette said, "I love to play," which in French means to act. And, you know, her eyes were all sparkling. She truly loves acting. She has such a fine, serious sense of acting. Look at that little skip that she does there. This is the Czech national anthem here, and these are the pigeons. Kundera talks a lot about the pigeons and the doves, and Alan Splett, our sound editor, insisted that we get the sound of Czech doves. American doves wouldn't do. Alan Splett was probably the greatest genius I've ever known in terms of sound effects editing, and in fact, Alan Splett edited the music and put all the music in here. We didn't use a composer, really, except for some incidental music. Alan's, the great tragedy is that Alan passed away a couple of years ago. In some way, I think we would all like to dedicate this film to the memory of Alan Splett.
I would have come earlier, but my mother...
At the very beginning of the film, we had written a long scene with Teresa and her mother. It seemed to us quite necessary to show Teresa's relationship with her mother, which is a very difficult one in the book. So the scene was there, and for some reason, which I don't remember, when the day came to shoot the scene, Phil Kaufman had some problem with the actress who was supposed to play the mother. And the set was built, you know, all the technicians were there. It was during the shooting of the film. And all of a sudden, Phil Kaufman asked himself, do we really need that scene? He called me and he said, just that, do we really need that scene? And I said, all of a sudden, no, we don't. And he decided not to shoot it. And it happens sometimes that a scene that, or a moment, or a line that you find absolutely necessary when you work on the script, when you see the images, when the actors are there alive, they say so much by themselves that you don't need the literary explanations anymore. So you get free, you get light, and you save some money.
Now, this is, I think this is Pierre Gruffat's masterful set. I mean, this is done at the Studio Bologna in Paris, and that's Prague out there. I mean, that's Prague done in miniature and perspective. Kundera has said that the woman who Sabina's character was based on was a friend of his named Irina Dedekova. Those are the paintings of Irina Dedekova, who was, in fact, the real Sabina.
I never actually met the artist who is Sabina. I think I didn't want to find out anything about her because it's not good. Whereas it's really good to have a novel to go to and read and create images and think about your character. But to have somebody stand in front of you and say, this is Sabina, then I think it sort of kills things that you would have done and choices you would have made if you, because then that would be the truth, which is really something you don't want to sort of even deal with when you're working and shooting a movie.
One of the discoveries I made on this film is that if you're cutting a scene that has a mirror in it and you're going from the shot of the two people to a shot of the reflection of the two people, what happens obviously in a mirror is that the people are now on the opposite side of the frame from where they were when they were not being seen in the mirror. So there's a sudden flipping of left and right. And if you use the normal techniques that you do in cutting, which is to pick up the action at a certain point, it's seen as a mistake because the eye has to get used to the idea that these people are on opposite sides. And so if you look at it in a detailed level, any time there's intercutting between mirror and non-mirror, you'll see that there's a huge degree of overlap in the actions. An action started in one shot will be repeated in the next shot, but you won't see it because your mind is getting used to the idea of these people are flipped. This shot offended a certain number of people at the time, particularly in America. Even though people could go to Macy's and see more bizarre things on mannequins and so forth, there was something about this that was felt to be, provocative or degrading or whatever. But, I mean, in fact, this was based on Kundera's recollections of Prague, of Prague Spring, and it was true to the erotic games that Tomas and Sabina played with one another.
Tomas.
They rarely look directly at one another, and yet when he says, what do you find interesting? I mean, obviously, it's an extraordinary tableau there. But he says, your eyes, Sabina. He feels at this point that he's, in a way, there's sex and there's love. And with Sabina, it's really sex, although, we know there's a deeper feeling between them. But Tomas is eager to separate the two, much as we will discover later, to Teresa's chagrin.
the scene at the doorway will later, it's a good scene to contrast with a scene that will come later, where the two of them meet at a doorway where it's Tomas entering.
Oh. You are in?
Yeah, you know, it's Little Red Riding Hood entering into the wolf's den here.
When I was living in Czechoslovakia in June and July 68, and then I came back there with Miloš when he was presenting Hair, I remember, much later, I was always struck by the fact that the Czechs had a very good and very strong sense of humor. Two aspects of the what could be called the Czech personality always struck me. One was the sense of humor. The other one was the eroticism. The strength of the erotic resistance to the oppression. That the fact that when a man and a woman, or a man and two women, or two men and one woman, or et cetera, are making love secretly in a bedroom, they are free from the political survey, from the political oppression. It's a way of resisting. We had long talks about it to Milan, with Milan and Miloš and other Czech friends, and that always struck me. And we try to put, you know, in the picture, these two elements, humor and love making, are two ways of not going along with the ideas which are imposed upon you, which are compulsory. It's a way of being yourself, of doing something which is pleasant. I mean, making love and laughing are two very pleasant things. And we never saw any reason to fall into a real pathetic and melodramatic atmosphere. And Milan Kundera agreed totally with this attitude. So it was really intentionally that sometimes in the film we put eroticism, which is already in the book, of course, and peaks, little bits of humor.
Everything looks fine.
They would come to my apartment on Sunday, our day off, and we would rehearse for hours, go over the week's work, because they just wanted to try to understand all of these things and get it right and be able to prepare. They were, you know, always ready from, you know, early morning, and you know, we shot long hours. And but both of them have great senses of humor, which is, to my mind, one of the great things that an actor can have. It's hard for me to imagine a great actor without a great sense of humor. The great thing was they did that fall without stunt doubles. We couldn't use the most interesting character in the book, which is the narrator. That is to say, Kundera himself. I've always felt that narrators tend to flatten out the screen. Instead of Kundera's voice, actually, we used the music of Janáček, Kundera's favorite composer. Kundera helped me select some of the Janacek performers or performances, you know, the ones he thought were, you know, the most evocative of the Janacek that he knew and appreciated. It's a romantic theme that runs through Janacek, but before it can get too romantic, there's always the notes of modernity in a way, the note that resists going fully into romanticism to the point where it becomes kitsch. You know, the big challenge was to take the Janacek music and, in a sense, turn it into the narrative line of the film. And Alan and I spent a good part of a year going through all the music and trying to find the appropriate places where it could convey what we felt, or what I felt was the spirit of Kundera's book. So this is actually shot in Lyon, but this looks very much like Prague with steps. Well, you can see Pierre Gouffroy added sculpture up on the steps there. There's the guitar music, which, you know, at this point was heard all over the streets of Prague. This is Donald Moffat, a wonderful actor who, when I did The Right Stuff, he played Lyndon Johnson. And the actor behind him is Tomek Bork. He was a Polish actor. We tried to use, you know, actors from Eastern Europe, largely. And you'll notice when Daniel Day-Lewis speaks that he has a Czech accent. We felt that with the great international cast, that if everybody had a matched accent, or somewhat matched, and, you know, they would all seem to be part of the same movie. This is Pavel Landowski, who was arguably, at that point, the most famous Czech actor who had run from Czechoslovakia and was living in Paris, but he's now back in Prague and a good friend of Milan Kundera's.
Good. You can get back to your farm. We just need a small procedure to replace the bone flap.
This is a wonderful actress, Pascal Kolenski, who was living in Paris, Polish background. But like, you know, so many actors in Paris that turned out to be marvelous people to work with. I was really surprised. I've done two movies in France, this and Henry in June, and there's just marvelous actors in France.
Goodbye, Doctor. I never met Kundera. He had a godfatherly relationship to the film. Kundera certainly made his presence felt, but not as far as I was concerned. I never met him, and he was around to a certain extent while they were shooting studio material and some location material in Paris, but not to the extent that Michael Ondaatje was around on The English Patient. On the other hand, historically, the writer of a novel is almost disinvited from ever participating in the creative evolution of the film, and that certainly wasn't true in the case of Unbearable Lightness. Kundera was invited to read the screenplays and to comment, to make suggestions, and to have opinions about the casting of the film and where certain locations should be shot. I'm sure that his influence had something to do with the use of the documentary footage in the film, although Phil has always been interested in that kind of device, as you can see from the sort of documentary footage in The Right Stuff and in White Dawn, actually. So Kundera had an intermediate involvement in the evolution of the film.
You want me to put this on?
It's cold out, Doctor.
What I loved about the book is the way Kundera views the world. He's concerned with ordinary people who are swept away by history but remain ordinary people. And that's maybe what the film is about, too. It's a love story with tanks.
Kundera was always extremely interested in cinema, in film writing and making. He even taught cinema at a certain period of his life in one French university, I believe. And he knew very well that writing a film and making a film has very little to do with writing a novel. So at the very beginning he said to us, take the book and do whatever you want. I mean, don't hesitate to change. I know it is going to be a film. I hope a good film. But take all the freedom you need.
But we only live once. Life so light.
I had read the book. I was actually a big Kundera fan. I loved his books. All of this was the one book that I didn't look upon as a potential movie at all, since it's very philosophical, and to me there wasn't a story. It wasn't cinematic in the sense a lot of his other books are, actually. And with a novel, and with a great novel, or even not so great a novel, I think it's so much help, because you just go back to the novel and you find things and you find little irrelevant things or unnecessary things that nobody ever sees, you know, but it's there and it sort of builds the character in a great way. So it's actually very helpful. It's wonderful to have a great... It's just like you don't have to do anything. You just read the novel and there you have the character and then you just go. It's great. I mean, it's not anything that you would see if you just walk across a street. And with the knowledge of everything you know from the novel about the character, I think it sort of creates something to that shot, even though it's nothing you can point out. But it's just that you have a character. You walk across the street as your character instead of you walk across the street as Lena Olin playing Jenny or whatever the character is. You know, it's like it's so much easier to become that character if you have a great novel.
Very messy around here. I always try not to get too attached to a place.
Tomas sees his sock now.
What's the people?
Well, yeah, here, you know, the two women have a certain bonding that's going on here, and Tomas, who seemed to be so in control of things at the beginning, now suddenly finds himself on the outside looking in. And that's part of the epic of Tomas, that he now is not able to participate in this moment. These are these Lee Miller photographs. They're marvelous. Lee Miller, you know, was Man Ray's model when she was younger, and then was a great photographer in her own right. I just felt that Man Ray would be somebody that Sabina would have been influenced by, and particularly in Man Ray's photographs of women, and which is, in a way, a kind of a forethought or a foreplay, if you will, for scenes that are to come later. So something is being planted here that will later bear fruit.
Here's the tea I made.
Yeah, so the two women sort of go back to... They find things that interest them more than Tomas here.
What is it?
tried to, in this film, to really be straight line and not to get into, you know, showing the dream, rather staying on the actors' faces to try to understand them through what they're saying. There's a tendency, or in some films it's appropriate to go in and visualize everything that could possibly be visualized, but what could be more visual than Juliette Binoche's face?
I stand by your rule. Not to move at all. You made me watch.
You know, we see something strange here happening to him, even though the scene seems to be happening to Teresa, and that Teresa is the one being comforted and so forth. There is a transformation going on with this firmly committed hedonist, Tomas, and this is another stop on his epic adventure, epic erotic adventure, and you know, in a way, she's leading him. You know, as the poet leads Dante through the underworld, she's leading him through. There's some steps that he's never been onto before. But what he's whispering in her ear actually was a scene that was written by Milan Kundera just for the movie. Is asking him saying we needed something here, and he wrote this beautiful little thing that he's whispering in her ears.
Like a broom among brooms in a broom closet. Like a tiny parrot. Like a whistle. Like a little song. Song sung by a forest within a forest.
This is where he's smelling her hair, in contrast to a later scene where she smells his hair.
The trick with the invasion was to integrate it into the body of the film. One of the devices that Phil had come up with was to create this little sequence. You see something in color. She takes the photograph of it. It freezes and turns to black and white, and then continues in motion in black and white. That's the first time that we begin that elision from one reality to the other.
One critic was very upset because he said that Hey Jude wasn't released until after this time, but in fact it was released in Prague, and that was the then wife of Jan Nemec who was singing it, and it was sung in Prague at exactly that time. So this photograph that's being developed is, that's me and my wife Rose and Peter, that was taken in Berkeley in exactly that time, maybe even to the day in 1968, but we felt we could have been in Prague then. Well, the Golem, meant to be a group there, but the Golem, of course, is the great legend of Prague, of, you know, the monster who protected the ghetto, made out of clay. And unfortunately for the actors here, for the characters here, there was to be no Golem protecting them.
Teresa, this is my colleague, Jerzy.
It is.
The chief.
Hello. Please.
Wonderful. You've really captured the new spirit here.
Well, Jerzy is a composite of a number of characters, but both Jerzy and the head doctor there, you see, are very much on the side of the Prague Spring, although later they pretty quickly can slide over to the other side because they are grand opportunists, really.
Has
But it's not as simple as that. The pressures of the society, you know, here we're seeing society in lightness, and after the invasion we see society in its heaviness, and the unbearable heaviness of society, and certain people, in order to survive, crack. Or certain people, in order to survive, go along with the easiest, or follow the easiest possible way of doing things. So there's a little party functionary here.
What would you say about Tomas?
This scene is a good example of the kind of problems that confront an editor, which is the precise integration of three or four realities that are going on simultaneously. Here you have a scene which has one, two, three, four, five people sitting around a table, which already is complicated, because you have to keep all five of those people alive and participating in the events. But it's also something that involves a band playing a certain sequence of music up on stage, which has to integrate with certain comments that they make at a certain moment. So the length of the scene has to dovetail exactly with how long the music is going. And then also there is a conversation between some Russians that is going on at another table that the people at the first table have to comment upon, related to how the Russians are responding to the music on stage. And then there are some incidental things that have to do with people making out in the upstairs gallery and other things that are sometimes more easily integrated because they kind of float freely. But here we have certainly three levels of independent reality, all of which have to proceed in harness without tripping each other up. Clearly a great deal of work goes into integrating these things at the time of shooting, but still there's an opportunity for you to stumble over your shoelaces in putting it together editorially, and you want to do it as quickly as possible and as effectively as possible without the first cut being a terrible mess that everyone panics about. You want it to seem like all difficult things as effortless as possible right from the beginning.
When Oedipus realized that he had killed his father, unknowingly killed his father, and was sleeping with his mother, and that because of his crimes, plagues were ravaging his city.
The strange thing was that when I went to Moscow and took the film there, we went to a restaurant after the showing of the film, and off almost in exactly the same position, there was a table on a raised platform with characters exactly like this that were party functionaries sitting, and we, the filmmakers, were all sitting with a bunch of people at the very beginnings of the Russian glasnost, and there was this somber table of dark figures, the eternal return of, or motifs repeated.
All I'm saying is that morality has changed in Oedipus.
That change that you hear in the music is something that was intended by the screenplay, that the point where this kind of lugubrious theme in the background suddenly becomes rock and roll coincides with the concept of morality changing. Exactly how it got worked out is something that was dependent on how those three elements coincided, both the music lasting exactly as long as it should last, given how long the people took to say what they had to say. It's easy for any of those things to overshoot each other and for the stuff not to actually happen at the same time.
We were having a lot of problems finding somebody who felt just right. I was in a hotel room in London. We were about to fly to Sweden to meet Lena Olin, and I happened to be watching an early morning television show, and Daniel was playing Mayakovsky in a stage production of about the Russian poets, and there he was on television with his head totally shaved. But there was something about him, just in his the kind of mad look that he had and the sense of humor, which Daniel has a wonderful sense of humor, that made me want to meet him. And within an hour, he was in my hotel room, and we just hit it off. And I just felt that maybe the character could just be younger, and that the love story, in fact, could be a younger love story. And that really that would represent the Prague Spring more clearly and more forcefully than if he were, as he in the book, if he were in his 40s.
No, he isn't. Juliet's original urge in her teenage years was to become a clown in a circus, and she trained as a clown. She went to clown school and has a whole repertory, if you can get her going, of little clown tricks that she occasionally uses. So Juliet's approach to the material was very different than Daniel's approach. And Juliet is unique in my experience as an actor, in that she can hold true to a central conception of what her character is doing at any one moment, but from take to take, give you a different interpretation of that material, and yet nonetheless do it in a way that allows you to intercut those various things without it seeming like the actor is having a nervous breakdown. And it's, for an editor, it's the most wonderful thing, because she's giving you a palette of emotional colors and allowing you to choose the yellow of jealousy or the green of envy or the red of confusion, depending on what the scene needs at that moment, and doing it in a way that allows all of those colors to blend together into a finished performance that has this wonderful variation and color to it.
Both of you know your own medical records. I have to tell you this. Don't think life is a walk on a sunny meadow. Life isn't a walk on a sunny meadow, and life isn't a walk.
This wonderful pig, little Fisto. I spent a lot of mornings working with Kundera, and he worked on this wedding scene with me, but it was in a strange way similar to my wedding with Rose. At our wedding, Rose was so amused by things that she saw that she could barely, she really couldn't keep from laughing, like as Teresa's doing here. And the guy, minister who was in Boston, I mean the Justice of the Peace in Boston, threatened to call the whole thing off because we weren't serious enough to be married. That was 38 years ago. But this is such, you know, wonderful, you know, rebellious spirit. This is, Jan Nemitz sort of set this up. I mean, he said this is what they did at the Czech weddings and champagne fountain. For the depth of the philosophy, people can go back and read Kundera's book. We had to make a film. I hope the events can summon Kundera's voice out of the viewer. We had to find a thread we could pull out. We chose the lover's story, not just a love story, but all those different variations on love. We decided we would do a variation or an homage to Kundera's book, let people go back and read the book. But as Jean-Claude Carrière pointed out, we had to make a movie, and he was the one who really pushed doing a straight line version of this complex, complex philosophical book.
Let's call him Tolstoy.
The only thing I can remember that Kundera and I really disagreed about was the casting of the dog. Kundera wanted a boxer. And my feeling was that he wanted the boxer because that dog looked like him. And he was, Kundera, if you know his aspect, he looks very much like a boxer dog. And I personally felt that Tomas would have another type of dog. So I think we resolved that piece of, we resolved that argument amicably. But that was about the only thing that I can remember us disagreeing about. I tried to work as closely as possible with Kundera. And when he saw the movie, he called me from Germany, actually saw it in Germany, and he told me that he liked the film very, 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 very much. So I got four varies from him. This is a wonderful actor, Bruce Myers. He's worked with Peter Brook. He's Daniel and I actually went to see him in London before we started shooting the movie. He had a staging of the Dybbuk. And we thought he was a marvelous actor, and I later worked with him in Henry and June as well. We went to Prague prior to shooting, but not announcing what project we were working on. Saul Zantz had shot Amadeus in Czechoslovakia because that was a non-political movie. He was able, had a lot of access and knew Prague. So I was able to go with him, and Sven Nykvist went there. And I was in Prague a couple of times. We were able to look at Prague, study it. But, of course, we were not able to shoot there, nor were we able to shoot in any of the Soviet bloc countries. I had approached the Hungarians. And the minute they heard I was doing this book by Milan Kundera, they all turned their backs to me. They just could not discuss this book. This book was very controversial at the time. We had thought we were going to be able to shoot in Yugoslavia, but they said we could shoot some of the love scenes, but anything to do with the Russian invasion was not going to be allowed. So that's why we eventually ended up in France, which is the only place we were able to do this. I mean, this is one of the few dream-like sequences. It's rather than a dream, though, this is really a hallucination she's having. So felt justified, you know, despite what the fact that we didn't really visualize the dreams. This is something that was, as she was, in fact, seeing it, that Tomas, you know, the womanizer, she's feels a certain madness, you know, certain depression growing on her.
The use of music before the film has achieved its final form is a thorny topic, and you can get into sometimes violent discussions with editors about the right way to do this. But in advance of assembling the scene, I think it's a big mistake, for me at any rate, to use pre-existing music and to have the visual material be dependent on what the music says should be done. I like to have the dynamics go in the opposite direction so that the scene dictates what kind of music would be chosen. Once that decision has been made, however, the catchword for me is always expect miracles. I've been astonished over and over again with the precision with which an edited scene will find the music, pre-existing music, sometimes music that was written hundreds of years before the film was shot, sometimes performed decades before the film was shot, and yet putting the two of them together without any modifications, it's almost astonishing to think that they weren't conceived of in the womb together as twins, because one of them seems to be doing exactly the right thing at the right time to emphasize what the other is going to be doing, so that the interplay between the music and the visual is tight right from the beginning, if you've made the right choice of what music to use.
Oh, you're awake.
to them.
To whom?
To the other women. Take me to them when you make love to them. I'll undress them for you. I'd like to. Really? I'll give them a bath.
This is Binoche's extraordinary here, because not only was her English not that good, but she's doing it with this Czech accent and with this kind of delirium and anger. I just thought she was amazing here. And we did this many, many times, and she got better each time. It depends on, you know, whether you do cover shots or cutting, just depends on your feeling of the scene. I mean, here I'm staying on her because the performance is so extraordinary. You really just don't want to cut away. Sometimes cutting is appropriate. When it's like this, you know, cutting serves no purpose.
Well, the wonderful thing about this construction that Phil and Jean-Claude came up with is that an argument which has a completely intimate quality to it seems to be being underscored by a rattling restlessness in the universe itself. There is a low rumbling that sneaks in without you being aware of it that seems to perhaps in its earliest stages be music, or perhaps you're not even aware of it, but it's influencing how you take this story.
I can see it in your eyes.
That's a wonderful one-take shot there. I was trying to shoot this in somewhat the manner that I shot Invasion of the Body Snatchers in, with shadows and almost film noir and color. And now comes the intrusion of heaviness into this erotic tale. It was extraordinary. We were looked all over for tanks, and we were able to find a few actual Russian tanks owned by a French general. And they were exactly the tanks that had been the type that had been used during the invasion of Prague, and it was amazing that we were able to get them for this. You know, we prepared this for a good part of a year. I mean, this was sort of the centerpiece of the movie in a way, and I worked, you know, on storyboards in Paris and did, you know, really planned all of this out.
The nature of this material was almost metaphysically suited to the quality of the film, because the event that produced this footage was the Russian invasion of Prague. And the film students who were learning how to study film technique at the film school in Prague, when they heard this rumbling, ran to their home away from home, which was the film school, and Frank Daniel, who was the head of the film school at the time, had preceded them, and he'd opened up the stockroom and gave them all 16-millimeter cameras and raw stock and said, "I don't know what's happening, but get out there and film it. This could be the beginning of World War III, as far as I know. But your film students, document it." So within an hour or two of the invasion, it was being documented by dozens of cameras.
Well, I mean, to recreate it would have cost a fortune. We would have never been able to do it as perfectly as the Russians created a much better, staged it much better than we could have ever done it. This was, by the way, in Lyon, but it looks to me, feels so much like Prague, you know, with the kind of hills of Prague and so forth. And Sabina getting out of there, all these tanks coming down and stuff. Here again we see the Russian tanks that we had combined with some of the real tanks. And now our actors and stock footage, that's, you know, stock footage of the actual fallen students and people at Prague. There you can see the line down of aging the film, the kind of scratched. In addition to storyboards, I had the videotapes in a trailer in Lyon, and with Sven, we had three or four cameramen here, and we would set up our crowds out on the street. We would watch videotapes, and I would say, this is what the piece we need to go with that, and then we would rush out onto the street and shoot that particular piece that matched the documentary footage that we were trying to integrate our shots with. One day I remember we had, I think it was 74 setups, which it was extraordinary. We worked at really a fast rate doing these things. Well, Peter, my son Peter, actually found a great deal of this footage in archives all over the world. And we spent a lot of time, getting stuff out of archives and, you know, bringing it all together into San Francisco.
One of the techniques that we used to integrate all of this material was to take the new material that we had shot in 1986 in 35 millimeter color and make a direct negative off of that and directly off of the work print, not going back to the original negative, but right off the work print, make a 16 millimeter negative from that. One of the negatives was in color, and there were actually two black and white negatives. One of them processed for high contrast, the other one processed for low contrast. So we had three elements out of which we could then recompose the shot back into 35 millimeter.
But a lot of these shots were done by, you know, there's Jan Nemitz, by the way. The man who shot a lot of those shots is the one who was up in the balcony there shooting now in our film right there, famous Czech director of Prague during Prague Spring. And Teresa's shooting him, shooting his, in a sense, reshooting 20 years later the very film that he had shot 20 years earlier.
One of the things that Frank Daniel had told them was, when you finish the roll of film, give the undeveloped film to a foreigner who is leaving the country, because we don't want the Russians to get their hands on this material, because they'll either destroy it or use it for their own ends. So that earlier that same day, hundreds of rolls of undeveloped film began to leak out of Czechoslovakia like a sieve, going in whatever directions the foreigners who were leaving the country were going. There's a moment here in the film where you see Teresa run up to somebody and give this person rolls of undeveloped still film. Well, this was actually also happening with undeveloped 16 millimeter film. So the invasion triggered an explosion of film that traveled in all directions from Czechoslovakia. Some of it wound up in London, Brussels, Paris. It even got to the point where I would find a camera angle in Stockholm that was the reverse camera angle of something that perhaps came from Rome, so that in the same shot I would see somebody photographing the very shot that I was using, but from a different angle.
Have you gone?
That was actually one of the, on the first reading of the screenplay, it was an idea that came to me as a possible way of coming out of the sequence, that we could have Teresa take the photograph of this man and, as we had done earlier, turn this man into a still photograph that would then be lowered out of frame, revealing the face of the Russian interrogator behind him, so that we would, in that one click, go from an ongoing revolutionary event to an event in another reality. And it, because it's so abrupt and in your face, so to speak, it works because it's so upfront about what it's doing. And it has this kind of magical aspect that Russian interrogators are sort of hiding behind the very photographs that she had used to document the invasion, which is the irony of that following scene, that the very photographs that she was hoping were going to show the world how the Russians had invaded were being used by the Russians to prosecute people who were trying to document it. So it was like the snake that's eating its own tail. And that causes an emotional crisis in Teresa, from which she doesn't quite recover for a while. One of the other things that happened as the result of this invasion was that ultimately Kundera himself had to leave Czechoslovakia. So he too was propelled out of Czechoslovakia. He went into exile in France, wrote this novel about the revolution. The novel, almost like gravity running backwards, attracted the attention of Saul Zants, who talked to Phil Kaufman about directing it. And in the pre-production of the film, Kundera mentioned that there was all this footage shot at the time, and Phil worked this idea of documentary footage into the screenplay. And then 20 years after the invasion, Peter Kaufman and Walter Murch began going all over the world finding pieces of this footage wherever they had happened to land, and reassembling it into the film about the invasion that had produced the whole project in the first place.
While we were shooting in Paris, we had dozens, if not hundreds, of Czechs who were working with us, and a number of them would go back to Prague and secretly confiscate or steal street signs and props from Prague, and they would bring them back to our set so that in Paris, so that we were able to get the things just the way that they were. We had a lot of set dressing that was stolen out of Prague, but invariably they would come back at this point weeping from what they'd seen in Prague. And this was, very much like the actual crossings. I mean, this is very close to documentary footage of people crossing the border and the guards letting people through. I had met a lot of Czechs who went through exactly this kind of situation, fleeing their country. And here, Karen and the dog is getting older, and Daniel and Juliet are, this is their family. They're fleeing with their little family. This is before they really close the border down. When he returns, you can see that the border is closed. This is in the moments immediately following the invasion, the days following the invasion, when they decided to escape. And as he's crossing, one of the guards says good luck to him, and he says good luck back to him. And here, that's their last look back at their country. They think they'll never see it again.
Invasion of our country constitutes a clear act.
This was shot in a hotel in Geneva, and this is a very true scene, I think, of the feeling of Lena Olin. I mean, she really, I think, is expressing what she herself feels. She has disdain for the world of Kitsch, not only as the character here, but as a person. She's an extremely forceful, extremely bright actress who, you know, I feel her when I see this. I feel the Lena Olin that I first met in the lobby of the Grand Hotel in Paris. As soon as I saw her walking across the room, I knew that she was Sabina. And afterwards, it was a wintry night in Stockholm. We were walking across a bridge. She had her arm in my arm. And she said, I said, I want you to play Sabina. And we walked a few paces. And she said, I have to tell you that I'm pregnant. And we kept walking in silence. But I knew she had to be Sabina. And as I say, her baby was born after we began the movie. But, you know, I never really could see anyone else playing the role. So this is Derek de Lint now, a marvelous Dutch actor who plays Franz. And I think he's just got that great open-eyed sincerity. And he represents for Kundera the people who believe in the Grand March, the you know, that history ever moves forward. And he's... You just, again, another actor I was fortunate enough to have brought to me by someone.
I think it's Doris, just, you know, that it's someone who looks good, and it's just she's frustrated, she's unhappy, she obviously did not want to leave her country, and it's just an act of frustration. I think that's the way it starts. But then he's so sweet, and willing to understand, and just a very sweet person. I think that sort of keeps it going for such a long time. But I think first it's just like if you're sitting and, you know, tearing a piece of paper apart because you're frustrated, it's the same thing. And she uses her sexuality and she uses people that way, which is just her way of being. I think that love to most people is like you want to get so much out of it. You want to have safety, you want to have closeness, you want to be built up as a person, you want to have the tenderness, the guardian angel of your life. You want to have so much. But for Sabina, she doesn't need for him to be her father or her friend or anything.
You think so? Of course.
She just wants him to be her lover, and that's to her so much, and she doesn't need him to be anything else. Obviously, she means everything she says in this situation, but it's about something else. It's about the two of them, sort of. She gives him a chance to be fascinated by her and sort of be, she gives him a chance to sort of fall in love with her while she's talking. I think that's more what it is.
Look, these plastic flowers. They even put them in water. And look out there. Those buildings. The uglification of the world.
I love that line about the uglification of the world. It's a planetary process, and I can't stand it. You know, somehow all of our characters are, you know, overwhelmed by political forces, and in a way they're all losing, but there's something so staunch and strong about Sabina, so that even though that viewpoint is one... of a loser in a strange way. It's because that planetary process is going to win. She's indomitable. And that's what I love about the spirit of the woman that Kundera wrote. And it's what Tomas had to love about her. Well, I just would say that Anne Roth did the costumes, did a lot of research, and I thought, you know, really did a nice job, a great job, really, you know, not only recreating the period, but when you're on the road and moving around and keeping all this stuff together like that, and particularly, you know, as I say, with a lot of the under things and stuff, making sure they were exactly of the period.
Dan Roth is really a genius, and one of her great things about her is that you don't have a wardrobe, that when you start shooting, your wardrobe is there, and you can go and look at the wardrobe and see, oh, that's the skirt I'm going to wear in scene 32, and that's the blouse, which belongs to scene 29. It's just that you meet her, and she pulls things, and she puts things on you, and they look awful, and some things look great. And then sort of I felt like in real life that we were running through my closet, and for every day when we worked, we sort of pulled something that we needed, and, oh, this blouse is awful, it stinks, let's pick something else, and it's cold out today, so let's take a sweater. And I never actually had the feeling that it felt like my clothes every time I walked on the set, which is a great feeling, because your wardrobe can be extremely helpful, of course, because that's one of the things that creates the character, but it can also be in the way. You're in this Armani suit, and it's like just somebody else.
Be careful.
By the way, the other man in the seat there is Pierre Gouffroy, who designed all the sets. He's a brilliant man. When we would travel around looking for locations, he was always looking for the 3-star restaurant. He's the voyeur there, and she sees she too is the voyeur.
When Phil says that the film has to do with voyeurism, I suppose every film has to do with voyeurism. Every filmmaker is a voyeur, and maybe Phil Coleman, is even more a voyeur than another director.
This was a scene I just thought of that morning coming into Geneva, into Switzerland, and I just thought if the two dogs could play off each other, the Swiss aristocrat and the funky, scrappy little dog from Prague being snubbed by the people and the woman and the dog and the Rolls Royce. They really, you know, just to emphasize what outsiders our little family was.
Russians in Prague, we've seen these everywhere. The events are too remote now.
After the end of August, many friends, starting with Miloš Forman's wife and children, came to Europe. And I remember in my place, in my apartment in Paris, it was full of people, you know, sleeping on the floor and not knowing what to do. Shall we go back? Shall we stay here? Many of them didn't speak a word of French or English, so they had absolutely no idea, you know, beginning with Miloš Forman himself, about what to do. I have a family in Czechoslovakia. If I decide to stay in the West, what am I going to do? Shall I be able to stay in touch with them, to send them money? All these questions were, you know, all every day and every night we start talking and trying to help. And then I went to New York with Miloš to start working on taking off, and Miloš was cut off from his family totally. He had no more news from his two twins, boys and his wife. I mean, people do not realize what it was now. And, 2 or 3 years later, things were more or less, I wouldn't say fixed, on the contrary. But it was obvious that things are going to last for another period of time, which was apparently endless.
No. You're too kind, really. But I'd rather be a waitress or stay at home.
But would you be fulfilled sitting at home?
This is a favorite little cactus of mine. It was, kind of... schizoid phallus cactus. This is another of the Karenin dogs who's doing a wonderful job. Look at Daniel Day-Lewis, though. The scene is totally in his hand, that wonderful look he has. he's the dog himself there. He's transformed himself into a playmate of the dog. In a way, the whole story is the tragedy of... His tragedy is that he falls in love and ends up with one woman.
See you later.
Are you working, Mr. Fennell?
Yes, I'll be back later. You'll be all right?
Yes, I suppose so.
Again, this is the mirror motif, and lifting that shard up like that and finding his eyes in the background was an incredibly difficult shot for Lino Lin to do. Everything had to be choreographed and exactly right for that to work, and it was hard to do that. So here once again is the bowler hat motif. Unfortunately for Franz, he doesn't get it. And there's more that he doesn't get.
So I have a huge head, and I was saying, and I was calling from Sweden and saying, you have to find the biggest bowler hat there is in the world, because it's like my head is enormous. Fortunately, you can't see that I have such a huge head, because then nobody could act with me, because I would look like a monster. So you can't see. So people were saying, oh, we'll just find a hat. And they came up and I looked like Lauren and Hardy, you know, with that little hat on top of your head, because they were so tiny, all the hats. So I think they actually made a bowler hat that would fit me. They had to make one.
Tell me, Franz, why do you always have to take me to another city? Why don't you ever want to make love to me in Geneva?
I told you.
Tell me again.
Because I couldn't go home and go to bed with my wife.
You mean you couldn't go from one...
The costumes, of course, the period look of what she's wearing here is nice, it's... I love that little hand of hers there with the glove on it, sort of like Minnie Mouse or something. But, the mirrors work so nicely here, where you can feel the intimacy in the foreground of their backs and see the reaction of their faces. You get a shot of me and my wife Rose walking by right there. We happened to be visiting Switzerland at the time, and just happened to be walking right by there. Daniel Day-Lewis has this wonderful look. Now, to my mind, that looks like Milan Kundera. I mean, it doesn't really, the face, it's not the, but it's the angle, the tilt of the head. I'm sure Daniel had taken that from the way, the carriage of Milan Kundera, the way that Milan Kundera would look at somebody. And this little dance that they're doing here of, old lovers and sexual warriors getting together again is quite lovely.
How are you?
Fine. I'm fine.
I think Sabina is... I know that when you talk about Teresa's liking Sabina, I know that Daniel and Juliet and I were talking about that, and I know that Daniel was so sweet when he tried to explain to Juliet that you like her because you just have to like her because, you know, and it was sort of almost like we were in the characters when we were talking, and I could see that Juliet almost got a little jealous, you know, for real, and you know, there was... But for Sabina to like Teresa, I don't think she sort of stands beyond all those rules that if you're in love with somebody, that person can't be involved with somebody else. I actually think that to her, there aren't any rules like that.
He doesn't like my hat.
Your hat?
Everything was in the novel that the hat was sort of something both Sabine and Tomas were so, and this understanding with the hat, and yeah, it was all there, so we could play around with it. There's one scene where the hat is supposed to spin around, and it was such a hard thing to get because we did it in rehearsal and the hat did fine every time, but then when we did the shot, because I think there was a track shot or something, it was a complicated shot, and Daniel had to pick me up and carry me, and I'm not that, I mean, I'm heavy, so he had to carry me, and then they were supposed to go to the hat that would spin, and the hat never did it, and Daniel was like exhausted, and we had to go through it and go through it and go through it, and we had people, because somebody else was to throw the hat in the shot, because I couldn't, you know, deal with the hat and Daniel and everything at the same time, so they had like prop guys, they had, you know, other people, I mean, I think they went to accountants and said, can somebody spin this hat right? And we never got it the way we really wanted, but it looks fine anyway.
Naked women. Yes? Oh, it's you. Yes.
What?
Some woman said that I should do some nude shots. And
nude?
Nude shots.
For that, we'd better have a drink first.
When you're shooting two people in an intimate scene, everything has to be so precise. You really need an incredible intensity of focus. This kind of scene sometimes is harder to shoot than a scene with 500 people. In a way, the Russian invasion, the parts we shot were easier to stage than a love scene like this, because in a big scene, if you get a few details wrong, you can always take it back to the editing room. You can find ways of making it work and so forth. But in a scene like this, everything has to be right. Every nuance, everything has to be there. And if it's wrong, the scene fails. You have to get the emotional details right. There was something missing from the scene. It was just an exterior thing that to make them more intimate, put rain outside and put a fire in the fireplace so that you had that sense of, you know, that you have in the wintry days in a place like Geneva.
Haven't you seen him?
No.
So here also you see all the, you know, the mirrors that had been part of her love play with Tomas, and now she's taken the mirrors and is using them as part of her artwork, and you'll see what an important role the shards of mirrors play in the scene that's coming up here.
In this scene, there's a kind of a mixture of lyricism and suddenness in the editing, which goes with that ambiguity of the camera being both a weapon and a shield. That the beauty of the women doing what they're doing certainly has to be expressed. It has to be beautiful on the face of it, and yet there also has to be this undercurrent of unpredictability and suddenness, which you'll see in some of the ways that the cuts are done. There'll be a series of three or four lyrical cuts, and then suddenly, like when she pulls the curtain apart, as if to say, now we're going to get into it, no more veils. That cut is actually a big jump cut in terms of the action. There is nothing that really matches there, but the violence of the cut, the suddenness of that movement, the sound that goes with it, and what the music is doing all create that moment of something else is happening, so that that at that point the scene suddenly goes up onto a different level. And you'll see similar things all the way through the scene where, you know, sometimes they were triggered simply by a problem of how was I going to get from one place to another. Going back to the Tarzan idea, how was I going to get from one vine to the next? But other times I had plenty of ways to get around it, but I wanted to go for this suddenness because of how it made the scene feel.
Look up.
There are so many things going on, and how the power is changing between them. There's a kind of flow of energy from one to the other, and even though Teresa's fragile, there's something very freeing about this. You know, there's something about Teresa's weight being lightened in this scene, and there's something about the sexual. The lightning that sex gives to life. I once got a call from Stanley Kubrick, who said that he had really liked this movie and that he wondered where I'd gotten the Praktika camera. He had remembered that out of this scene, which I thought was an interesting thing to remember from this scene. But isn't that, in a way, that's the most erotic moment of the whole scene, is right there.
It was something that I know Phil dreaded a lot, too. He was sort of, oh, how are we going to get through that scene? And that's going to be a difficult thing to do. So I know that it wasn't easy for Phil either. And we sort of thought it through how we wanted it. And then me and Juliet, we looked at the stand-ins while they did it for the crew with no clothes on to chase and everything. And that, I remember, is very embarrassing because you felt like somebody else had to do your dirty work. You know, it was like... It's watching somebody go through your laundry. It's one thing if you just leave it to someone and it comes back nice and clean, but it's not like you want to watch them while they're doing it. And I that was the feeling we had when we saw these poor girls who had to go through the whole thing.
Take off your clothes.
But it was fun to do this scene. We had a lot of fun while we did it. And I think we both had exactly the same feeling about what we wanted to do. I mean, it wasn't like Juliette would say or have an intention and I would feel that this is not the way to go. I would always feel that we were on the same track, which was great. It's not more scary than anything else, really, for some strange reason. It looks as it would be to me when I see it. Oh, but it's not, when you're, because you're into the thing you're doing and you don't even think about it. And I'm very grateful to Sven when I look at this, because I think it's very beautiful the way it's lit too, and it's shot in a very lovely way.
Look at me, Teresa.
Certain sections of each, you know, it's divided into a number of segments or acts, this particular sequence, and generally it begins with a tableau shot.
Making love, I mean, eroticism, has a lot to do with the film. It's not an ornament. It's not something superficial. It's something which is really part of the behavior of all the characters in the film. The way Sabina, for instance, behaves when she makes love, the way Teresa behaves, including in the scene with the engineer, when she starts, you know, she tries to find a certain relief in the unknown arms of a man. All these elements are deeply connected with the subject, with the story. They are not there just like any flower that you could take off. Not at all. I mean, they are really part of this question, which is, when my country is invaded, when I cannot do anything I would be proud of, what can I do that which is worth doing, and I'm not ashamed of, and gives me some pleasure, and not only some pleasure, but the fact that secretly I know that I'm doing a free act, and that nobody in the world would even try in preventing me of doing this.
My books, my tuxedo. And I want to make sure she's all right. We didn't argue.
I mean, I don't know if it's a matter of American actors being prudes or not. People say that American actors couldn't have handled it. I'm sure certain, you know, we have great, great actors here and capable of anything. But I think, as it turned out, the European backgrounds of these actors, I think perhaps, if anything, added to the kind of maturity of the characters.
Till I get my bearings. If it's all right, I'll...
See, Francis, this is Kundera's essence of the Grand March, really. You know, the total openness, the total honesty, the extreme liberal that Francis, who doesn't understand the trap the world has become, which is, I think, Kundera's theme for himself, for the checks, and for the sensualist such as Sabina. She's moved to tears by Franz, but it's partly by his naivete. You know, Sven Nykvist is a marvelous cinematographer, needless to say, having shot, you know, so many of the Ingmar Bergman movies. He actually had worked with Lena Olin on, she was in After the Rehearsal, which was a film with Bergman. Sven light sets in a marvelous way. He just sets a few lights and is ready to shoot very quickly, and then as you do your reverses and change your setups, he just makes a few minor adjustments, and it's wonderful that you're not waiting for Sven to light. So many cameramen have such complex and extensive lighting setups that sometimes not only the director but the actors lose their momentum, but Sven believes in simplicity, and yet look at the beautiful light that he is able to put onto a set. He's really extraordinary. I mean, it's not by accident that he's called legendary. I mean, Sven has that kind of Swedish blue that he lights for. It's austere. It tends to go more towards the bluish tones rather than the kind of warm colors, so that when you do see an orange or skin color, it stands out more than if the whole palette were, you know, in that kind of reddish hue or more yellow. And Sven, on top of being a marvelous cinematographer and easy to work with, Sven is a very charming and sympathetic man, and it's very nice to be able to go to work each day with somebody like Sven.
Cinematographer-actor relationship is a special relationship, since you feel that this is somebody who takes care of me and sort of, and it's a difficult relationship, because if you look at something and it doesn't look good, then of course it's going to be the most hatred person on earth for you, that, you know, because it's tricky. If it's good, it's really great with the DP and the actors. I've known Sven since I was a child, because he was also friends with my father. So I know when he started making films internationally and he started traveling, and he always reminded me of that when I started working here in this country, because I always used to say to him, oh, that must be so fascinating, Sven, and you travel to this and that country, and what is that like? And I couldn't even imagine that I would be in that position one day when I made films outside Sweden. So I had known him for some time, but it was, I had even shot with him in Sweden. He just has something about him that's very soothing and wonderful, and he has a great understanding for what you're doing. And you really feel safe. He takes care of your face. He takes care of you when he's the DP, definitely. This is the first meeting I have with Daniel Day-Lewis when we did this scene. We had never met before. And it was such a bizarre situation, because it was, hi, how are you? I'm Daniel, I'm Lena. And it was, you know, we had to take our clothes off and start doing the scene, which was insane, because normally you have a rehearsal time before you go. But at this point, there were technical things with the movie. They had to be in another country, and then they traveled, and I, you know, I had to be in Sweden, and I couldn't travel till the last minute, so that's why it happened. We had never actually met before we were doing that scene. And when you see the scene, it's amazing, because I can't believe that these two people just met a second ago, which is actually what happened. We just said hello, we did shake hands, and then we went into bed.
About Kundera's novel at the very beginning, all my friends said to me, it's impossible to make a film out of it, of this book, of this novel. And I had a different feeling. Of course, I saw from the very beginning what we would lose. I mean, the philosophical aspect of the novel, the fact that sometimes the novelist comments himself what he's writing, and even sometimes the character of Tomáš is commenting his own action in the book. Also, sometimes according to a certain musical building up of the story in the novel, Kundera tells a certain number of events in a few pages and retells them again in a much much longer way. It means that he says twice the same story in different modes, which was totally impossible in a film. You can repeat an action. So from the very beginning, we knew that we would lose this. Nevertheless, was it worth making a film, knowing that it was impossible to make a philosophical film, to make an essay as a film, that we would need to tell a story? And our answer was yes. Why? Because when I read the book for the second time, I saw clearly that there was a love story between a man and a woman, and maybe two women. That love story had to overcome a real obstacle, like any love story. In that case, the obstacle was the coming of the Russian tanks, which was a real historical event, like history getting into the story. And in the same time, a second obstacle could be developed, which was Tomáš' behavior, I mean, his womanizer side, and also the fact that Teresa was very much aware of this and jealous. All the elements were there. And above everything, reading again the book, I found in a very few lines what was giving the book its title, The Unbearable Lightness of Being. At one point, when they are in Switzerland, Teresa and Tomáš, who are married, they are a married couple, they have a fight. And Teresa knows very well that he's, you know, making love to other women. And one day, she decides to go back to Czechoslovakia, to Prague, to her country, knowing very well what's in store for her. But she goes away, whatever the love she could feel for Tomáš. At that point, for a brief moment, in a street in Geneva, Tomáš is left alone. It's a beautiful sunny day. He's there, he's sitting at the terrace of a cafe. He's alone, he's free, he's finally light. And he can't stand it for more than 10 minutes. And himself goes back to Czechoslovakia. As much as Teresa's coming back was expected, was logical, was natural, Tomáš coming back was unexpected, because he had everything he wanted in Switzerland. He could be a surgeon, he had money, he had women, he had a very easy life. Going back to Czechoslovakia meant for him that he would go back to hell. He'd be obliged to get rid of everything, to lose what he had before, and maybe even to go until the point he would lose his own life. Knowing all that, he goes back. It's a perfect dramatic action, because it is in the same time, as Miloš Forman would put it, unexpected and unavoidable. Unexpected, and it is a very nice surprise when you read the book. And when you see the film, unavoidable, because it says, the action itself says that Tomáš loves his wife much more than he thought, loves his country much more than he thought. And maybe, and that gives the meaning of the title, loves a certain darkness, a certain danger, a certain black side inside himself, much more than he thought. That's the center action of the whole book to me. You know? And when I realized this, reading the book for the second time and talking a while with Milan Kundera, I said, yes, I think a film is possible.
Well, we had, you know, Jean-Claude and I had some differences when we were writing the screenplay, and I think the differences were the kinds of things that a lot of people argued about or discussed after the film was, you know, why would Tomáš go back for Teresa when he could stay in Switzerland with Sabina? And here's, this is a portent of what's going to happen. He returns in Prague, right on this very street. We'd seen a guitarist, we'd seen Prague Spring, and now, after the invasion, we see the funeral. And the street has this kind of Kafkaesque quality. Prague has returned to the time of Kafka now. And there's two Kafka types of characters. Everybody's spying on everybody else. Everybody looks like a character out of The Trial. Those same stairs were happy places. Those were happy steps when we saw them. Even the plant has died. There was just, you know, for me, something about Teresa that I fully understood, that I, to me, it just seemed totally reasonable that he would become obsessed by her and would go back, you know, for her, and would take precedence over politics and so forth. It's the sense of a man, you know, history is becoming a trap, but it's also Teresa's becoming a trap for him. It's, you know, their tragedy is that they are people, the people of the Prague Spring are the sophisticated people who are going, you know, approaching the highest version of modern history of, or up till then, the modern history of Czechoslovakia. They're the people who are reading, who are listening to classical music, who are interested in all the photography and the arts and so forth. And now Tomáš returns to this society that is interested only in a way, is, you know, people protecting their own asses.
What are you going to do here?
I'll find something.
This is quite different than the first time they fell into bed. Suddenly they're mature lovers in a world that's become more infantile.
I really don't like to do this. I shouldn't have to do this.
So now he's returned, and, you know, the very man who encouraged him to write these things is changed. The colors now become darker, really. Everything seems overcast in a way. Even the interiors seem overcast. The opening piece at the beginning of the film was a fairy tale by Janáček, and it really sets the tone of the fairy tale that we were trying to tell, or at least something that seems almost like, it seems almost like something that didn't happen or couldn't have happened, and yet it happened, you know, and it really is the thing that sets Tomás off on this odyssey into the horrors of history.
When Phil Kaufman says that this is a fairy tale, I suppose there is something quite ironical about it, because it's a real story. The film, like the book, tells about real people who have really existed, who have really suffered, who have really died, you know. If it is a fairy tale, it means that from a certain point of view, we can consider all the events of the history we have been through like illogical, fantastic, unrealistic events. As a matter of fact, the invasion of Czechoslovakia by the Russians was the fact of an ogre, of a monster, of something which is not in the real sense of the word human.
Yeah, suddenly all the people are smiling at him, and they know everything about his life. His private life seems to have disappeared. And Jerzy, who was a voyeur, a sexual voyeur, is now a political voyeur.
But who told you I had agreed to go along with it?
See you.
These are rain machines, but it's all about umbrellas and everybody sort of hiding under umbrellas, even though it's raining. It's a world without faces, really.
They can't say anything anymore. They accept everything.
Now that we're going back 10 years, we're going back to a world that has vastly changed. This was shot in a pre-glasnost world. It was before Russia, before the fall of communism. And many of the actors were living in exile from Eastern Europe and thought they would never be able to return home. Again, that myth of eternal return. Kundera himself, I think, believed that the Russian Empire would never collapse. So there was a lot of strain and pressure on in shooting the movie. There were even threats on people's lives and so forth. You know, if we had made the movie, it was politically rather a hot topic back then. Some people were resentful of the movie being made because it was critical of the Soviet invasion and so forth. And there were people who believed that all of that had been done in a good cause. None of the people who we had met in Czechoslovakia.
There is nothing you can do for me, Doctor.
This is a great Polish actor, Daniel Obryczki. He starred in a lot of Wajda's films, and after Zabolski, Daniel Obryczki, I think, became the leading Polish actor.
And many of the actors in the film were all people who had had roles to play in Eastern European society, but who were, for various reasons, forced to leave or fled. And it certainly lends an authenticity to what you're looking at, because these people had all gone through exactly the kind of thing that the scene is about. I can only imagine what it must have been like for them to play this, because no matter how they were functioning in Western society, they had still grown up in Central and Eastern Europe and probably had much family and relatives back then. And you have to remember, this film was made in 1986, 1987, when the Cold War was still quite virulent. Nobody knew what, at this point, what was going to happen in 1989 through 1991. And so to have these people say these lines in a film that was going to be seen by Western audiences, they could also only be nervous about what would happen to their relatives back in their home countries, Poland or Czechoslovakia, if the Poles or the Czech authorities saw this film and saw that they had acted in it.
One of the editors.
This moment coming up, always, I've always enjoyed it. It's, his hand drops like an axe. Tomasz. But, you know, this was very daring for Daniel Obryczki to do, because he was still a citizen of Poland and was going back and forth to Poland. And if given the time, this could have gotten him in terrible trouble, but he really believed what he was saying. And to be in this movie and do this character he was playing here really could have cost him a lot. It was a real joy to work with. You watch all of the moves that a master actor does here. He hadn't done, I don't know if he'd done other English language movies, but he worked very hard on this, and he felt that English and Polish, the certain rhythms were similar, and he speaks, he does it beautifully. Look at it.
Used. Whether you meant to or not, your article contributed to the anti-communist hysteria. Nobody requires a doctor to understand politics.
Films shot with long takes were something that I had been used to right from the start with The Conversation, which was shot in takes of sometimes 10 or 11 minutes in length. Is a style of filmmaking which is more European than American, and Europeans historically have always shot in long takes, which need these film editing tables that can handle up to 1,000 feet at one time easily. The moviola, by contrast, becomes increasingly awkward when you get over 200 feet long. So when American films began experimenting with European techniques in the late 60s and early 70s, that's when the European editing machines began to be seen more and more frequently in American editing rooms. Interestingly, this was a film that we began editing on a moviola, which is a editing machine that historically has been used in Hollywood from the late 20s on, and soon realized that it was not going to work, and we converted to editing on the Chem, which is the twin of the Steenbeck. The two rivals for European editing systems are the Chem and the Steenbeck. And I had used the Chem on Conversation and on Apocalypse Now. I'd used the Moviola on Julia. And when I came to work on Unbearable Lightness, I, thinking about it in advance, thought that it was going to be more like Julia, but it turned out to be more like The Conversation.
This was a shot that made everybody certain that we were shooting in Prague, where he becomes a window washer, because that is Prague behind him there. But in fact, it was a large photo of Prague put in perspective with lamp posts and stuff. that we put on, you know, on the stage in Paris. But this, to a lot of Czechs, they were convinced that we'd snuck into Prague and shot the scene there. That's why I had the scene filled with soap and then him rubbing the soap away and revealing Prague.
Good evening, Excellency.
Why do they call him Excellency? He was an ambassador in Vienna before.
Now, this is Erland Josephson, star of many Ingmar Bergman films, and one of the greatest living actors, The Excellency.
I knew Erland Josephson from Sweden, and I knew him well. He and I actually did after rehearsal together with Bergman, so I knew him well. Unfortunately, I don't even have a scene with him in this movie. It's just that, you know, he came through the hotel and he did a scene, and that's about it.
Sky, I had myself convinced that they'd gotten Leonard DiCaprio at an earlier age. Doesn't he look like him?
Give me a drink.
All right.
You have beautiful legs. I watched you in the street.
Prague, when I visited, was a city of deep silences. The main streets were hushed. People, even though they were crowded, the streets were quiet. It was a somber, oppressive atmosphere. Occasionally, somebody would whisper to you about changing money, but I've never been on, you know, huge streets like that that were so quiet. There was a definite silence that had come to Prague. Everyone was afraid to speak openly, and we would be in restaurants, sitting way over in a corner of the restaurant with a few people, and everybody who lived in Prague would be afraid even to whisper, knowing that the place was bugged and the table was bugged. Even in taxi cabs, people were being afraid. People were afraid to speak because everybody could get into trouble.
There's an unwritten and sometimes written rule in the film industry that films need to be 2 hours long. To do a long film, there is a risk involved, which is that, first of all, it won't get as many showings per day, so you won't make as much money theatrically as you would if it were shorter. The most common criticism of any film, in a negative sense, is it was too long. Whatever length you're aiming for, you want to have a, let's say, a heft to the film that is appropriate to the story that's being told. You can get a film like Fargo, for instance, which is a very short film, but it seems like a longer film. The heft of the film is such that you don't feel like you've seen a short film, which is great. On the other hand, you can get a film like this, or like English Patient, or like The Godfather, where some people see the film and say, I didn't realize 3 hours went by. I was so into the story. And that means for them that you found the right specific density of the film, which is the relationship between what length it has and the amount of detail and involvement in the story at any one moment.
What are you doing here?
This is Stellan Skarsgård, who was the star of Breaking the Waves. This is his first English language movie. Wonderful Swedish actor.
I live very near here.
On the lower tier, off to the right, the man in back carrying the pole. Is our producer, Saul Zantz. You just get a very brief glimpse of him down below there.
Hello.
surround you.
Every novel is a new work. I mean, needs a new way to approach and transform it. On the other hand, you need at a certain point to be free. I mean, to close the book and then to make a film. The question is not to be faithful to the book. The question is to make a film. And a film needs to be totally alive by itself. If you keep always next to you the book, coming back to it, finally you will end up with a book with illustrations, but not a film. A film has its own energy, its own movement, its own language. And that's absolutely essential to go from one language to the other one. So you take a book, first of all, and as I said, you have to decide if there is the possibility of the film, according to the material, to the story, to the characters that you meet in the book. For instance, when I was working with Buñuel in Mexico, we have been offered many times to adapt Below the Volcano by Malcolm Lowry. And every time, I mean two or three times, we read the book again and again. We liked the book very much. But at the end we said, no, we cannot see a film. If you take out of the Lowry's book everything which is literature, writing, what's left? A drunk man, you know, wandering around the streets of Cuernavaca in Mexico and falling into a hole at the end. That's all.
This is Consuelo de Havilland, very good French actress. It was also been a ballerina. The main thing is that she's married to a party functionary, and in a strange way, that sort of spurs on Tomáš to want to continue this a little bit. It's the only triumph he can have over the bureaucracy. He realizes that she's also married to sterility.
It's here.
So here we are again, they're in bed, and this is in a way counter to that earlier, one of the earlier scene where he's in a way smelling, talking into her ear. And even though the scene has an awfulness to it, it's, I think Daniel is quite comedic here. Well, the camera here is, you know, I mean, we're shooting straight down on them. If we were to fall from the camera, they would be in trouble here.
What's wrong?
And these are, you know, these are very difficult scenes for the actors. I mean, the camera is right above them. It's all one take. You know, it's a long, fairly long scene that has to be done perfectly. So there are a number of takes, and it's grueling on the actors.
I thought you had come back here for me.
I have my own self-imposed rule, which is that I don't want to go onto the set of a movie ever. I don't want to see how the movie is actually being shot. I want to see the results of that on the screen. But the editor is really one of the only few people who is intimately involved with the creative process of assembling a film who can, and I believe should, protect themselves from too great a knowledge of the method by which the film is made, because the audience will have no knowledge of this. The audience only knows what it sees on the screen, so that if you know that some moment was particularly difficult to get, you will tend to prize that moment more than perhaps you should. At the same token, some moment that might be quite magical, but that was done accidentally or when everyone was in a bad mood, you as the editor can recognize, this is actually very interesting and could be good in a different context. You're free to imagine that kind of stuff, but if you've been there all along, you know too much, and you will be inhibited from having that kind of freedom to think about restructuring or recomposing things in a different way.
Now, this is a building we found in Lyon. Sort of her innocence coming down the stairs as she goes up. And Teresa trying to find lightness, trying to find out how Tomas, even in the most repressive of circumstances, can view sex as sex and love as love.
Oh, hello.
I've just tried to come.
Yeah, come in. It's a very simple
I think
place.
For Kundera and the Europeans, sex was a part of everyday life, and for Americans, particularly within our tradition of film, sex was a taboo. Sex, you know, we had periods where sex was virtually banned from films, and I think if you were doing a film about Prague Spring and what came after it, you had to include the sexuality. Even though certain American reviewers were put off by it. So earlier, there was a time when she takes down the Oedipus Rex book, and once again, that sort of makes her think this might be the right man for her. But in this scene earlier was that has a slight perception that she might be being trapped by something. And in fact, that's what it turns out to be, that all of this in a strange way is that the sexuality in the repressive society is what is going to trap her. No. I don't know. For me, it's, I've had long-running arguments on films like this where if you're involved with the sexuality in a way, they give the film the rhythms that action scenes give other films. A lot of people would prefer to see a series of action scenes where heads are shot off, or even, a woman's breast would be mutilated or something, rather than see a sexual scene. But for me, the beauty of these sexual scenes is that they are beautiful, and that they are what, if you're involved with the film, are giving the film its rhythms.
There's somebody here, behind that curtain.
The films I've done in Europe would be Swedish films, and I think this is very much like a European movie. But I think the difference is not, I think,
so why don't you throw something
that when you feel that the sex is not in the story, it's not part of the story, it's just, that's because some of the American movies, they have the story, they have the whole thing going, but then they feel that to attract a bigger audience, maybe we should have some sex scenes and some love scenes, and sort of just put that on like something you put on a cake, so that people will want to come and see the movie. And then it becomes ridiculous and awful and just stands out like nude scenes. Whereas if it's there in the story, which in this case obviously it is, since it's a story about this man who is and his relations with women and his sexual relations with women. But so in this sense, that's what the story is. And then and of course you don't think of the sex scenes as sex scenes, but. But I think what happens a lot of the times is that you have the whole story, and then, oh, gee, we have to have a woman, we have to have some nudity, and of course that becomes totally wrong.
There is that other level of sex film where, sex is violence or verges on violence, and it's, going for... you know, really going towards the pornographic rather than the erotic, or going for the, in a way, you know, the meaningless, the sex that stands outside of character rather than the sex of characters. I mean, here, to my mind, I mean, you have, I think, one of the greatest actresses in the world willing to do a scene like this because she believes in the subject matter and the scene and what the film is saying.
What are you looking at?
Although the coverage on this scene was such that I could have shown him as much as I showed her, it seemed to be interesting to put the film together from solely showing her, so that the kind of the anonymity of the sex that she was after here, to sort of go with the anonymity of her idea of what Tomas's sex with other women was like, was emphasized, so that we never got into how he felt about this. Although the coverage on this shot, for instance, there is an angle in which you saw his face, but it seemed to be much more interesting just to stay with her and never to see who this person was. I mean, we knew very well who it was, but you never see her point of view of it.
Anyway, here we see once again the swimming pool and her theme echoed and haunting here in the film. The only time it's really slowed down in the film, because it's almost her vision of herself trying to purify herself, whereas the water is always, or the last time we saw it was a form of purification. So here's Erland Josephson, and what he did here that was extraordinary was, I was setting up the scene. You know, we had talked about the character and it's the ambassador who had once been a great man and now was sweeping floors. And suddenly I looked over there and there he was, slumped into the corner, almost as if he had removed his spine, which was a perfect metaphor, the perfect physical act for the character who had become spineless, really. And virtually the only motion that he does is adjusting his cuff with his hands. Most actors would try to chew up a scene like this, but he is so confident and so subtle that he does virtually nothing physical, and he becomes that much more powerful by playing the scene the way he does it. I mean, it's a man without a backbone, a man who's destroyed, and yet he becomes, for her, a wise man who is able to show for her once again the trap the world has become.
That's Vienna in 61.
Oh, yeah, when we showed the film in Moscow, Kennedy, Khrushchev, and actually Erland Josephson is in the background of that himself. We put his photo in there. That got a big laugh. I mean, the whole film, in a way, was a revelation in Moscow. In 1989, we went to Moscow, where Unbearable Lightness of Being was being shown as part of the Moscow Film Festival. But it was being shown secretly. Word got out that this film was being snuck into that showing. And the screening started in a theater of 3,000 people at midnight. Now, you know, the film is virtually 3 hours long. So that meant people would be getting out at 3 a.m. Subways stopped running at midnight. There were 3,000 people inside the theater showing each night, with 1,000 people trying to get in out on the streets. And when they saw the film, they were amazed at the content of the movie. They really had not seen, most of them, or not known this side of the story of Russia's involvement there. The invasion footage was a revelation, because they had taken Jan Nemitz's film and made a different film of that. The people were weeping for the Russian liberators who were protecting them against radicals. They had seen exactly the same footage in a different context. After the film was over, people were running up to me and embracing me and kissing me and some of them sort of felt that this might be the case of what happened, but they really had never seen a film that showed this side of the story. And anyway, that was an extraordinary moment for me, because this film was shown right at the very beginnings of Glasnost, and maybe had some small part to play in some of the changes that were taking place in Russia.
I don't want to stay here. I want to go away. To leave.
Leave? Again? We left here once. We were in Switzerland, then we left Switzerland. Now you want to leave again. Why? I don't understand.
Prague has grown so ugly.
No. I know there's another reason.
The most difficult part of the writing and the making of the film was the last part, after Teresa's and Tomáš coming back to Prague. We knew very well that from that moment on, there is no more action. They are condemned to lose everything, to retire to the country and to die. They have no more motivation to do something. They are just trying to survive and not to lose each other. And they are in a certain way helped by the presence of a dog. But you need, if not, it's not necessary to adapt the book if you get rid of this very important part. You know, you can't just decide that the film is going to stop when they are coming back to Czechoslovakia. We're waiting for something. We need something more. And what was extremely difficult in this film especially was to build up, I would say, around 35 or 40 minutes, which is very long, of the film with no action, with no what we would call an action. We mean a dramatic interest. What's going to happen? What? And the only way to build it up was to use something which is very, very rare to work with, which is building up a story, not with events, but with feelings, with sentiments, going from one feeling to another one. And that's what we did in this film. I suppose it was the most difficult part of the film to write and make. And if there is something interesting in the film, I'm not sure, I'm never sure of it, it's in that adaptation that it was a sort of what we would call a challenge. You know, was it possible? Is it possible to write 40 minutes of a film knowing that the two characters are going to an end without almost resisting, without fighting, without hoping anything? And the challenge was there.
We'll never leave.
They were some of the earliest scenes that were shot, these scenes. They, because of the time of year in September, they had to shoot all of this country stuff early.
Harvesting malt for beer. That's you know, in Czechoslovakia, beer is being one of the, at that point, one of the big exports.
when you have lost everything, when you don't recognize the city you live in, you were born in, when your country has disappeared, does not exist anymore, is invaded, one thing is left, always, is the countryside, the birds singing, you know, the brooks, the meadows. Something is there which seems impossible to destroy, to change. How could a new political system kill the cows, prevent the birds to sing, you know? What does it mean for a dog to be communist or not, you know? That's part of the reflection, part of the secret atmosphere of the book, of the story that the book tells, and the film also, of course. So the fact that they retire, they go to the country looking for something which cannot be really expressed, cannot be really said in words, I think it's there. And if you listen carefully to the soundtrack, you will realize that all of this is in the film. And the fact that with this dog called Karenin, and which is a salute from Milan Kundera to Tolstoy, his favorite writer, the presence of Karenin, the very special relationship they have with an animal, also has something to do with a fairy tale, an unrealistic story.
No, that's their family. That's all the family they had.
I was supposed to love my mother.
I mean, it's, again, Tomáš came to this. Suddenly, he's noble.
Tomáš. Maybe I love her more than I love you. Not more. I mean, in a better way. I'm not jealous of her. I don't want her to be different. I don't ask her for anything back.
I mean, some people ask, you know, why this didn't descend into Kitsch or become trite, and I really think it's, you know, the concepts of Kundera here, that, you know, what they're discussing, and the way in which he presented it. It's, there is a truth to Kitsch before it becomes Kitsch. And maybe, you know, this was, we're trying to find how a scene like this can move you without being a cliche. I love that little moment there where he finds Teresa's photos of Sabina, which he didn't know about, at a moment like this. This actually was the scene that Juliet read for Daniel and myself when she was auditioning for the film, that just brought us to tears just sitting in a room.
Please don't be there.
replacing Kundera with Janáček, the very music that he himself had suggested. We find in Janáček's smaller pieces a kind of a voice that's almost a conversational voice that can carry some of the narrative that has both links the romantic and the anti-romantic. Kundera, says that his sources, he's often quoted as talking about Musso and Bruch and even Cervantes as being, the people who influenced him most in his writing and perceptions. But strangely, here we find music of Janáček with its beauty and yet its kind of cautionary quality and its kind of deep thoughtfulness and, in a way, strangeness. If Janáček isn't more popular, it's because not everybody was willing to follow the lyrical lines of Janáček.
The fades to black in the film, which are fades to black and then cuts to the next scene, so they're not fade in, fade out, they're fade out, cut to, are probably the holdover from a technique we were thinking about at one time, which was to have titles similar to some of the things that were in the novel. And there's some of that at the very beginning of the film, but at a certain point, we were thinking of doing it much more in the film. And I think what you're looking at now in terms of those fades and then cuts to are relics of that approach, which was effectively abandoned, except for the little bit that you see at the beginning.
See, now we're finally seeing all the skills of Tomáš the doctor.
One more time.
Kundera also loved Stern and... I'm sure that Tomas is a kind of Tristram Shandy character. He also, loves Cervantes, and there is the sense of Don Quixote in a strange way about Tomas, even though he isn't a guy who, goes knocking down windmills. In a way, he is a guy who ends up sort of, he pursues women the way Don Quixote pursued windmills or bands of wild pigs.
That is always pretty. Yes, I know. But especially today, seeing you in this...
This is actually Pavel Landovsky's nephew, Pavel. He is, in fact, his nephew. He lives in Paris, and he's a marvelous actor of... he's been in other movies since, kind of a Gérard Depardieu presence.
And we'll take you on a pistol.
The film is seen subconsciously as a fairy tale, perhaps, certainly not overtly as a fairy tale. It seems, on the face of it, to be the story of how individual people respond with their decisions in the face of overwhelmingly oppressive historical odds against them. And yet there is something very personal and charming and lyrical that emerges out of this, which is the fairy tale aspect to it.
This woman is Margot Capillier, who cast the movie. It was the French casting director for this film. She had worked on Children of Paradise, actually. She was the doyen of French casting people. She also cast Henry and June in Europe. This was one of the hardest scenes to shoot because each time they entered the room, the pig crapped on the floor. And so every time they entered, they would come in and scream and the pig would go. And we did about 20 takes and it was the same each time. Comparatively speaking to some other films I've worked on, this is fairly close to the script. The book itself is told in a non-linear fashion. But what Phil and Jean-Claude Carrière, the screenwriter, had done is to take out the non-linearity to a fairly high degree and to tell it in a straightforward fashion. Once you do that, the kind of flexibility that you have in going from past to present is eliminated because one scene seems to lead to the next. Inevitably, as in any film, there were structural recompositions, but nowhere near what it has been for me on other films, such as The Conversation, or how it probably would have been had the screenplay retained the novel's non-linearity. The structure of the novel is put together kind of the way somebody does cross-country skiing. One ski moves forward and then stops, and then another ski takes up at the halfway point and moves forward, and then the ski that stopped moves forward. So these chapters have a sort of overlapping linearity to them, and as you begin the fifth chapter, you are rereading things that happened in the fourth chapter, but from somebody else's point of view, and now you go off into new material that is recapitulated at the beginning of the sixth chapter. The film doesn't really get into any of that.
Some characters are just so, it comes to you so easy, and it's just like dancing on grass with bare feet. It's just, you know, it's just wonderful and easy all the time. And Sabine is one of those rich characters where you just go, and there's always something, you know. It's like a candy store. But it's not like you can say, this is the best character, this is the character I like the most that I've ever done. But Sabine is one of those characters that was really a delight to work with. The first time I saw the movie was actually the first time I came to the States, and I went to Los Angeles, of all places, to do some publicity. And then I saw the movie for the first time, and it was such a shock because I had no idea that this was the film. It was a pleasant shock because I was sitting there and I was just like, "Gee, this is so wonderful and it's so beautiful." And we spent 6 months shooting this movie, going back and forth and a lot of traveling. And it was just like this period of our lives that we just went through with a lot of fun and a lot of, you know, we just went through the shoot like we were not making a movie. And then when I saw this movie, I was really surprised. Oh, gee, it became a movie.
That's Walter Murch's house, by the way, in Bolinas. I call it the first church of Walter Murch. The actor, the man in the background, is Niven Bush, who's a great Hollywood, was a great Hollywood screenwriter, a friend of mine. He wrote Duel in the Sun, I think both the novel and the screenplay. And I think he was the co-writer of The Postman Always Rings Twice, the original version of that. He passed away a couple of years ago. He was a really, truly great man.
The brakes on their truck didn't work.
Two or three times before the death of Teresa and Tomáš, in his book, Milan announces it. He says that they are going to die. And I try to do exactly the same in the film, but in a different way. It means that's why we see at one moment Sabina, who has gone to America, receiving a letter. And in that letter, she learns about the fact that, you know, Teresa and Tomáš are not alive anymore. And then we go back to Czechoslovakia and we see them alive, which creates something, you know, it's playing with time in a way, but in the same time it's trying to create a certain expectation of, we know now that for the last 10 minutes of the film, they are going towards their death. How? Why? When it's going to happen, we don't know. That was an extremely interesting way of working, which is very rare in a film. And the very end of the picture, we were really hesitating. It was very, very difficult to end.
This was shot in a little hotel in Bez. It had about 8 rooms in it. And as they go down the hall, Sven, Nyquist, myself, and Rose are in the next room watching it on a video monitor. And this room that they're going into actually was the room Daniel Day-Lewis, this was his room in the hotel. I shot a number of different endings. Shot the ending in the book with the moth circling around a light and them and being in bed the last day. And it's, for some reason, that didn't have a dramatic impact. Shot another scene where they danced around a room. It was a very arduous, difficult shot, a 360-degree shot that, as they were dancing, came to rest outside. You could see outside the truck, as if something from a Cocteau movie, the ominous truck waiting to lead them to their deaths. That didn't seem to have the impact we wanted. I shot another scene on a stage of them walking over the Prague Bridge and being followed by Karenin, so we would know that all of them had died. And that seemed too fanciful and so forth. So she says, Tomáš, what are you thinking? In fact, she didn't say that at all, but we were able to disguise it to make it look like that was what she was saying. And then off the point of view shot, Tomáš says, I'm thinking how happy I am. And that, you know, brought him full circle. He's in the end, in a strange and tragic way, he's cured finally of his womanizing, and it's the end of his life. And even though it's the saddest of endings, it's a happy ending. And there up ahead in the point of view shot, as we drove through the woods around Bez, was a shot that had this opening in the road, light coming through the trees, and suddenly the screen seemed to get unbearably white, and they drove into the whiteness, into that lightness, and that's how the film ended. The ending was in footage that we'd already shot. Strangely, as the Eskimos would say, the figure is already in the stone before you carve it. You just have to wait for it to speak. And as I was going through the footage, the footage spoke to me and said, "This is your ending. You already have your ending."
The finished film is, without question, a director's cut, and to that extent, it's also the editor's cut. I'm happy with everything that's in it, and I'm happy with everything that's not in it. because what you're trying for is this internal balance of everything to produce a specific density of story relative to the length of the film where everything seems proportionate. And that's the goal of all goals. You're not really trying to put together a series of wonderful moments. In fact, you can probably make wonderful films out of secondary moments. My favorite story on that is the story behind Carl Dreyer's Joan of Arc. When he'd finished with the film and was happy with it, he got a telegram from Germany that said that the negative had been destroyed in a fire at the lab. It was impossible for him to reshoot it. And the question of what to do then loomed, and what he did do was to go through and, with all of the outtakes, which were not destroyed, put together the film that today we know as one of the all-time 10 classics of film history. And yet, ironically, it's a film made completely out of material that he rejected. And that's really a metaphor for the kind of decisions that we're always making, that we will do anything to achieve that balance, cut out our favorite scenes, include scenes that we don't like personally, but that if they help the film to achieve an overall dramatic rhythmic balance, that's what we're after. And so those other questions are really secondary and ultimately irrelevant.
So many people think that, a film like this was, only a commentary on totalitarian culture and so forth. And yet there's this sexuality and this moment of openness, which in a way is repressed in our own society. And some of the very things we fight for creatively are things that are fought against by elements in our society, and we're not even aware of it sometimes, just as the Czechs perhaps weren't aware that in Prague Spring that there was a kind of an open and a golden moment. Maybe, we too aren't aware of, the transience of these times in which we live.